WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
Last year, you wrote a book on, well, your book on skyscrapers was published. Why are skyscrapers so special to you?
Well, I could say just because they're there, they've always had an enormous amount to do with the image and the romance of cities. It's very hard to imagine any great American city without skyscrapers, except Washington. And it's really the great American building form. In the way, say, that the musical comedy is the sort of great Native American theater form, the skyscraper is the great American building form. That's not to say everyone should have them or live in them or build them all the time any more than we should have all musical comedies instead of plays. But it's just something that is worth exploring in terms of what it says about our culture and our cities and what we want. And the other reason I decided to write a whole book about them was no one else ever did. So it was sort of there waiting to be done.
I guess that's really surprising to me that no one ever did write a book on skyscrapers.
It was surprising to me, too. I mean, there certainly is a lot about skyscrapers that you find in other books. But when Alfred Knopf, the publisher, came to me and said, you know, we'd like you to do this, we both looked around and there really hadn't been anything since a book in the 20s that was called The History of the Skyscraper and that was almost more of a big portfolio. And it included, well, it only went up to a point where they had drawings for the Chrysler Building, which was yet to be built. So you can imagine how much wasn't in that book.
Well, because of skyscrapers like the Chrysler Building, you call New York the place where the more flamboyant and theatrical skyscrapers were built, and Chicago the place for the more intellectual skyscrapers.
Right.
Would you explain
right.
that?
Sure. It seems to me as though for a long time there's been a kind of a personality battle between New York and Chicago, battle of image, battle of style, whatever. And Chicago has always been a place that's built in a sort of a rigorous, practical way. Intellectual is one way to look at it, but it's not quite so simple as that, because, in fact, some of it was also a kind of a Great Plains, Middle American simplicity and straightforwardness and no-nonsense. And Chicago's really where the modern skyscraper was born. Where Louis Sullivan, where John Wellborn Root, many other great early modern architects did their work, and they struggled very hard to find a way in which this new building form that was like nothing else we'd ever seen before might be expressed through a new architecture. They believed that it was a new kind of technology, a new kind of object, new kinds of needs, and therefore it should be a new style to express it. In New York, we saw things very differently. New York has always been more flamboyant, more theatrical, more concerned with appearances than with certain kinds of reality. And New York had also always been a city that had indulged very deeply in the American predilection to take bits and pieces of history and play games with them. And we'd been doing that in New York throughout the 19th century anyway, with great mansions and commercial buildings and other things. And New York architects simply began to do it with skyscrapers as well. So New York skyscrapers tended to look much more like sort of stretched out versions of Gothic towers or Victorian things blown up to larger scale or classical temples suddenly of a height that no Greek or Roman could have ever conceived of. So the New Yorkers were trying to sort of distort the stage set in a way. The Chicagoans were more trying to sort of be more rigorous and say, okay, we must find a proper way to make skyscrapers. I'm not sure New York architects were that interested in proper ways to do anything. They were much more interested in having a good time.
This is a question that I think people are still musing about, but when skyscrapers first started to be built, what were some of the predictions about how they would affect life in the city?
A lot of them were dire. In New York especially, but also to some extent in Chicago and Boston and other cities. There were predictions that huge crowds would clog the streets, that the city could never possibly support the services needed for 20 or 30 or 40 floors of people all piled in the same place, that they would trample each other to death going to work in the morning, that everything would collapse. The strange thing is that all of that was kind of paranoia back then. Now we're beginning to hear some of those things again, and I think this time they have a little more meaning, particularly in New York, where we're building to a density that I think was never conceived of even early in this century. And things, at least in East Midtown, are beginning to get clogged to a point where some of those doomsday predictions of 60, 70 years ago are really now, ironically, beginning to come true. But back then, there was a great deal of fear that this would totally destroy the city. There was also fear, by the way, that it would totally... even those who were optimistic about skyscrapers believed that it would more dramatically change the city than, in fact, it really did. In my book, there's some wonderful drawings that we found that we reproduced from way back then of cities with sort of bridges connecting the upper floors of buildings for blocks and blocks, and aerial transport. And it was envisioned in those days that there would be things almost like helicopters bouncing from roof to roof, and bridges, and people movers, and all kind, and different levels of the sidewalk, and all sorts of things. But in fact, what we see much more resembles the conventional, traditional city of the 19th century than anyone then thought it would.
Did anyone worry about the buildings not being able to support themselves and then falling down?
A few people worried about that back then, except the evidence was pretty clear that they were going to support themselves because there they were. And there was some initial fear at the very beginning, which really goes back to the 19th century. But the first skyscrapers, of course, were really buildings that we would never even notice today, at least in terms of height. They were buildings of 10 and 12 and 14 and 16 stories. They were so without any danger of collapsing. They were sort of solid, bulky boxes almost more than anything else. That I think that tended to, when they began to get a little bit bigger, there was not really any great fear. Remember, the skyscraper didn't go from not existing to 100 stories. I mean, it was sort of a gradual movement toward bigger and bigger ones. And therefore, I think there was a little less fear that the whole thing was going to come collapsing down around us.
You said that some of the fears that were just paranoia when skyscrapers started to be built are becoming real actual fears that are,
sure,
are grounded in reality now. Like what?
Well, let's take New York, for example. The area of the East 50s in Midtown Manhattan is becoming overbuilt to a point, I think, that was never envisioned years ago. It was never assumed, really, that we would have a 40 or 50-story tower on every single block, one next to the other. Not only does that take light and air and comfort and open space out of the city entirely, then you really do begin to get to a point where the people don't fit. The sidewalks, the roads, the subways are all overcrowded to the point of madness. And I think we're beginning in some parts of New York to reach that. So there are absolute limits to density somewhere. You cannot keep on cramming more and more people into space forever. You can fit a lot more than people thought 75 years ago. And in some ways that's good because, in fact, density and congestion up to a point are a very enlivening force. They're a very nice force in the city. They are part of what urban life is about and should be about. There's an emptiness to a suburb that, in fact, is the antithesis of what urban life should be. On the other hand, somewhere there's a point at which all of that density and crowding and togetherness becomes not a healthy, energizing thing, but a dangerous force, because it just gets so ridiculous that nobody can function, or people become paranoid and crazy and start hating it.
Do you live in Manhattan now?
Yes, I do.
How do you relate to the architecture of Manhattan? Especially the skyscrapers.
I love it. You love it? Yeah, and in fact, the first book that I wrote before The Skyscraper was a very personal architectural guide to Manhattan called The City Observed. And that's sort of a personal ode to the architecture of Manhattan.
Did you grow up in New York?
Well, the real deep, dark, dirty truth is that I grew up in the suburbs in New Jersey.
Well, when you used to come into Manhattan to do whatever it was you'd come in to do, did you feel claustrophobic when you got there, or did you love energy and the
architecture? I felt exhilarated when I got there. I think it was – I don't know if kids feel this now. Maybe they do. I tended to feel more claustrophobic in the suburbs, in spite of the fact that there was grass and trees and open space. I felt open and free in the city because I think cities, at least great cities, convey a kind of psychic and emotional freedom to people. And that's the trade-off for physical freedom. I mean, you don't have freedom of space because you're more crowded. You can't go out in the backyard and take off your clothes and sit in the sun. You know, you give up certain experiences like that. But you get a kind of emotional freedom in return. Because you get the freedom of choice. You can do anything you want in a great city. You have so many more opportunities than you do in a small town. And so you really are trading, in a way, space and openness for other things.
If you're just joining us, I'm speaking with Paul Goldberger, who's the architecture critic for The New York Times, the author of several books, the most recent of which is called The Skyscraper. In New York, there hasn't been any limits to the growth of buildings, either to the number or
yeah,
to
no,
the
there are actually limits, sure.
Yeah?
There always have been. In fact, New York was a leader in establishing limits, believe it or not. It's just that there's so much growth in New York that it's pushed those limits to the extreme. New York established the very first zoning laws in America, and zoning laws are really the mechanism by which cities do limit and guide growth. And that was back in 1916. The problem is that probably the zoning laws are not strict enough. There's a double problem in New York. The zoning laws are not strict enough, and they are also somewhat subject to negotiation. So that over the last few years, builders have tended to negotiate their way around certain things, certain restrictions, by the city's own encouragement. What happened back in the 60s was it became very popular to do something called incentive zoning, which began in New York and was then copied elsewhere. The idea was there are all kinds of things that people deserve in the city, like open space and plazas and what have you, and that builders of new skyscrapers should be required to provide those, and in exchange, the city would let them build the buildings even bigger. Well, in fact, what happened was that they really got the better deal because the plazas were often meager and not very good anyway, and they were given bonuses far in excess of what made sense. For example, a skyscraper would often be permitted to be 20% larger than otherwise if a plaza were included. That's one floor for every five could be added. Well, it cost the builder very little to put in the plaza, and he would make millions and millions of dollars in extra income in perpetuity for the extra space. And ultimately, we got ripped off. There's a tendency today to move a little bit backwards, and the city has revised the zoning laws to be somewhat less liberal, to restrict negotiations somewhat. But there's still a tendency to permit buildings that I think are often bigger. There's a really basic problem, particularly in New York, which is that you don't have a very good city if you develop every single block the same way. As I said, a 50-story skyscraper is better with lower buildings around it. It can be seen better. There's light and air and views for the people in it. It really seems to make sense. On the other hand, there's a philosophical problem, which is, does the city have a right to go to you if you own one block of land and say, we've decided the big building in this neighborhood should be on your land, and then come to me who owns the piece across the street and say, you can only build a smaller building? Well, that's unconstitutional because it's simply an unfair use of the city's power. So how do you guide growth while still treating all landowners equally? It's a very touchy, difficult problem. It's sort of a little bit philosophical, a little bit legal, and a little bit architectural and planning. It's sort of a little bit of all of those things.
Philadelphia's skyscrapers are not really skyscrapers. They're very modest in height.
Compared to New York or Chicago, they are, although compared to the early skyscrapers, of course, they're big.
What kind of affinity do you have with Philadelphia Center City architecture?
Well, there's a lot of wonderful architecture in Center City, Philadelphia. If we're going to stick with skyscrapers, there's, of course, PSFS, which is one of the great skyscrapers of the 20th century by George Howe and William Lescaze. It's really the preeminent international-style skyscraper in America, the first one, and among the very greatest examples of that sort of crisp, sharp, European style of modernism translated into the American skyscraper. There are ideas in PSFS that have been used elsewhere since and repeated so often and so badly that they become trite. And so it's easy to look quickly at PSFS and not see anything really special. However, when one realizes that building is 50 years old and many of the ideas and forms in it were originated there, not elsewhere, one can begin to see how it's more special. I think the basic mood of Center City architecture is really different, though. It's not PSFS, which is a kind of a unique thing. I think of Philadelphia as sort of middle-size masonry buildings that are more classical in mode and feeling and are kind of nice and really fit, make a nice sort of knit web together. I mean, buildings like Wanamaker's, buildings like the buildings on Broad Street, the other side of City Hall, between City Hall and the Academy of Music, which are not extraordinary in their own, but somehow together they really form a nice city fabric. And then, of course, very, very special buildings like the Academy of Fine Arts, which is, I think, one of the great buildings in all of America. I mean, we're getting very far from skyscrapers, but I never like making this kind of list, but if someone ever forced me at gunpoint to make a list of the 10 best buildings in America, that would probably be on it. And then there's the whole really wonderful way in which City Hall is a perfect symbol and anchor. I mean, it's so right that the City Hall should be tall, have a tower, be beautiful, be ornate, and be exactly in the middle of this great intersection that the whole city is built around. It's sort of as if you ran Paris from the middle of the Place de la Concorde or something like that. It really is exactly right, and it feels right, and it gives a kind of order to the whole city in a way, and a city needs order. A city that has only order is boring and dull and fascistic, but a city with no order at all is chaos. And this provides a really nice sort of beginning symbolic order that then allows the city to become much more diverse around it because it kind of anchors it in the middle. And that's really super.
The buildings that you just described, City Hall and the Academy, don't fit into this category. Most of the skyscrapers do fit into the category of being buildings for corporations.
Right.
How has that corporate affiliation affected the form and function of that kind of skyscraper architecture?
Well, it's true. Most skyscrapers are corporate offices of one kind or another. It's affected it simply in that office space tends to demand fairly neutral open spaces. And skyscrapers are very good at providing that because it's just space one on top of the other. Some of the worst skyscrapers of the last few years are often jokingly dismissed as file cabinets. But in fact, those are often buildings that serve a certain function, which is providing office space, and they serve that function very well. Unfortunately, they completely ignore their other function, which is to help provide a civilized environment for those of us who are not working in them but merely pass by them. But the other way in which, of course, corporations' demands and needs have affected skyscrapers is that corporations have often wanted to use skyscrapers as symbols of their power and might and so forth. Thus, they were made higher very often and pushed to the top, pushed to something higher to stand out. The skyscraper has stood in many American cities kind of in the same sort of role that the church spire used to have. And what that says about God and mammon, I don't want to go into. It's all too obvious. But corporations have often vied with one another for the tallest or the most prominent tower. It's no accident that in most American cities, it's the big bank building that's the thing that stands out. You go to a middle-sized city anywhere, and generally sometime in the 1960s, the bank built a big glass box. And that's the sort of church spire of that city is the bank. You go, in fact, not, you don't even need to go to a small city, big cities too. In Chicago, Sears and an insurance company, John Hancock, and a couple of banks are the great presences on the, or the tallest presences on the skyline.
What do you think about when you watch King Kong and he climbs up the Empire State Building?
It's nice. I love the Empire State Building. And one of the things that makes it so effective is that the makes that scene so effective is that the Empire State Building is so powerful as a symbol. It symbolizes not only great height, but also sort of romance and inventiveness and excitement and exhilaration. That's, I think, one of the reasons that the Dino De Laurentiis remake with King Kong climbing up the World Trade Center didn't work so well. Because who really cares if he gets to the top of the World Trade Center? I mean, yes, it's a little bit higher, but it's so dull and so boring. And so it didn't fit with King Kong ever.
Paul Goldberger is my guest. He's the architecture critic for the New York Times and the author of several books, the most recent of which is called The Skyscraper. Well, there are new cities being built now in the Midwest, in the South, in the West. Are many of them using skyscrapers or relying on skyscrapers for not only the extra space but the vitality that they can provide?
Most of them are. They're, again, for symbolic reasons as much as anything else. Houston is a perfect example, which is really the ultimate new American city, for better or for worse. And it's a city of the automobile. It's a city that sprawls out across the landscape. Yet it also has a core of skyscrapers in the middle and a number of skyscrapers out along the freeway as well, partly because skyscrapers still do have symbolic power. And even though they are expensive to build, Houston now has one 80-story skyscraper and is getting two more.
What kind of trends do you see happening in these new cities, architectural trends?
Well, the greatest trend has been toward sprawl, toward accommodating to the automobile, which is too bad but perhaps inevitable. Frank Lloyd Wright predicted in the 20s, and nobody really believed him, that the automobile would revolutionize the American landscape. The automobile has had a more profound effect on American cities than anything else at all. And most of our problems in the last few years have come from trying to force older cities to accommodate the automobile, which they really can't do very well. And we end up with awkward, unpleasant compromises. Generally, places that are built entirely around the automobile lack a certain kind of urbanity that we associate with old-fashioned cities and like. And that comes from pedestrian scale, from the actual act of walking, from things being organized around people to walk, from chance encounters that come when people are on foot, from juxtaposition, from crowding, from all that business of being together. That doesn't happen in an automobile city, really.
Are there already things that some of the new cities are avoiding because of things that happened in the older, newer cities? In other words, are there already mistakes to
Sure, there are lots of mistakes, but people don't always learn very fast. Sometimes they learn too slowly. Houston, though, is probably a very good example. It has begun to turn back in on itself somewhat. It's not continuing to sprawl anymore. People have finally begun to realize you cannot keep going out on the highway forever and ever, that eventually it just gets to be too far and too impractical. And land closer in is beginning to have a second growth and development now. Smaller buildings being torn down for larger ones instead of new ones being built farther out. Second, Houston is, which has for a long time prided itself on its complete absence of zoning laws, on its belief that you get a better city by letting people just do what they please, is changing its mind. And there are now the first restrictions being put into effect in Houston.
In a recent article about the restoration of the New York Public Library on Fifth Avenue, you wrote that it's really unusual now that there's to have any monumental civic architecture, and that seems to be a thing of the past. What are the social implications of that?
Well, they're not wonderful. We can't really afford monumental civic architecture anymore. I think we're trying. I think we want it more than we did just a few years ago. So maybe our society will find a way to get it, but we don't have a lot of it. I think we're still in a time that is best described by that Galbraith phrase about private affluence and public squalor. We don't really believe particularly in noble public spaces anymore. Can you imagine in today's economy and today's political climate deciding to build Central Park or Fairmount Park? I mean, it's just unthinkable. It's all we can do to pay for people to continue mowing the lawn in those places, and we don't always manage to do that. And I think that has a lot of implications. I mean, part of it is simply money, but part of it is, I think there's less of a sense of shared civic purpose in cities and communities than there used to be. We believe much more in the individual, which has both its good and bad side. I mean, to some extent, that belief in the individual is just an example of selfishness and nothing more. But when it comes to the public, I think, or the public treasury, I think probably we're more inclined to, we're much more generous, say, in welfare payments than people were in the days when we built great civic architecture. You have to pay for it somehow. I mean, there's no free lunch. And so before we condemn our time too much, I think it's important to remember that in the days when we were freer in building great public monuments and public places were also days when if you were out of a job, you starved because society didn't have any responsibility for you. I mean, I still dream of a time when we can do both, but I think we've moved to the individual in a sort of double way, really. Rich people just because they're selfish, the government because it's chosen to deal with individuals more. Although, of course, with the pendulum swinging away from that right now politically with Reagan and all that stuff, that may begin to shift too. What we are seeing is a little bit more of a return to monumentality in private architecture. In the AT&T building in New York, which is really the most interesting and important new skyscraper of our time and is about two-thirds finished now, will have an enormous six-story high entrance arch on Madison Avenue with a whole colonnade of classical columns below it. Well, that's an extraordinary act for our time to create such a piece of monumentality. It's being done privately, not publicly, but it'll be a public space anyway.
What are the formerly monumental civic buildings being replaced by now? What kind of civic architecture is there?
Right now, I sense the tiny beginnings of a trend back again. So let me take a step back and say a few years ago, they tended to be replaced by simple, efficient file cabinets. I remember my predecessor at the Times, Ada Louise Huxtable, once did a really wonderful column on two courthouses in Jersey City, this great, wonderful Beaux-Arts courthouse that was just sort of full of every political association of grandeur and sort of great 19th century politics you could imagine, and this awful little file cabinet of a modern building that looked like it was an insurance company or something that was replacing it. There was a belief once that a public building was a symbol, that it symbolized all the aspirations and dignity and hope and power of a community. That all became subsumed in the bureaucracy in a way. When maybe we can trace some of the beginning to the United Nations, when that was finished in the early 50s, I was looking back at some old columns Lewis Mumford wrote in The New Yorker about it, and he made a brilliant observation which is, he said that, you know, the commanding building, of course, is the Secretariat, the office building. The General Assembly, which is the legislative building, is low. He said, for the first time, the architecture has symbolized the fact that the bureaucracy has triumphed and that the bureaucracy really controls the government, and it is itself the symbol of everything. And the other thing is just a little low outbuilding tucked, you know, sort of tied onto it, which is exactly right. And that is, in effect, what has happened. If we were building Washington, D.C. today, I doubt that we would make the Capitol the commanding presence. We'd make all those millions of boring, banal office buildings, unless we had the sense to do it otherwise. And I think we're beginning to now. I think there's a reaction setting in against that excessive banality. And some of the newest civic buildings that are being talked about or under construction in some American cities do begin to try to push the pendulum back somehow.
Paul Goldberger, the New York Times architecture critic, is my guest. It seems that so much of the new architecture is built for shopping, the shopping malls and fast food things and shoe towns and furniture stores on the highways.
Right.
What kinds of precedents are those creating? What do you think of the roadside architecture and the shopping mall architecture?
Most of it's pretty boring, pretty bad. The roadside architecture is a response to the fact, and a catering to the fact, that people want to be in cars and not on their feet. Although what we've done really with these malls is put people in their cars, cause them to drive away from the real Main Street, and then have them get out of their cars and walk back and forth on a pretend Main Street under a climate-controlled mall. It's sort of like having a make-believe, sterilized version of a city instead of a real one. On that level, they're sort of disturbing because they're canned places, really. It's a canned urban experience. I mean, it's a sort of an urban experience because people now go there. I mean, the great change occurred, I think, about 10 or 12 years ago when these places became so common and also so big that people began to go to them just to go there, even if they really didn't want to shop. Well, that's the equivalent of the way in small towns years ago, people would take a stroll up and down Main Street just to promenade and to be seen and see and run into people and window shop and so forth. People now drive to the mall to walk back and forth. Well, that's quite a comment on the lack of any kind of real experience of human connection that the suburbs gives you, that you have to sort of go and drive into this canned place to walk back and forth and have an experience of human encounter of some kind. Now, nonetheless, you know, some of them are better than others. And also, as they get bigger and bigger and more successful in some areas, they begin to take on more of the attributes of real cities and become more interesting and a little less canned. So they're not an altogether bad thing. They're also beginning to spawn urban imitations now. I mean, the great irony of sort of, you know, the suburban attempt to imitate the city is now coming all the way around full circle to be imitated in the city, in Los Angeles and Stamford, Connecticut. There are huge new downtown versions of suburban malls right in the middle of the city. And then even in Philadelphia, something like the Bourse.
Or the Gallery.
Or the Gallery. The Gallery is actually more suburban. You're right. The Gallery East is very much a suburban mall put in the middle of the city. The Bourse is a little bit different in that's really a restoration of a very beautiful old building turned into retail uses, and I think done very successfully, by the way. I think the Bourse is one of the nicer examples of that kind of place anywhere.
I'm interested by what you're saying, that this canned environment in the shopping mall can be at least partially transformed through use to something that's more real,
right,
and less
that's
canned.
That's true. Absolutely.
How do you see that happening? Can you think of any examples of that happening?
There are more and more events taking place there, reminding us that the malls really are becoming town squares as much as anything else. I mean, if somebody has a concert there, if somebody collects money for a charity there, if somebody has a the real great test will be if someday somebody has a political demonstration or a march or a sit-in in a suburban shopping mall. I mean, that will be the sign that they have become our new cities.
I'll look for that. That's interesting. Paul Goldberger, the New York Times architecture critic, is my guest. Let me quote you. You, in an article about preservation of churches and theaters, wrote that architecture preserved provides symbols of continuity and stability. Would you elaborate on that for us?
Sure. I think a city has to have some sense of time in it. We really feel lost in an environment that's all new, and we feel even more lost in an environment that changes constantly. And I think what any city has to seek is a balance, because a city that doesn't change at all will die. I mean, it becomes like Williamsburg. It becomes just fake. But a city that changes so fast loses a certain kind of meaning. And, I mean, it's very important to see, again, we talked about City Hall as a symbol. It's very important to know that City Hall is always going to be there, that there's no intention of having a Philadelphia without it, that if you have a little kid, you can bring him or her there and say, this is City Hall, and not have to worry that if you send the kid, the kid grows up a little bit and takes a round-the-world trip and 6 months later comes back and there's a new City Hall. I mean, you know, and says, what is this? Why? In fact, you know, cities are things that people believe in. They have personalities and we expect things of them in the same way that people serve that role. And we want them to remain somewhat the same while still changing and growing and becoming more prosperous and all that other stuff. So a city seeks a balance, I think. And Philadelphia, in fact, I think has been very lucky in having a very good balance. I mean, there's a lot of wonderful old architecture here, and yet it has not stopped this city from developing a lot of new architecture.
What kind of conflicts are going on in your home, New York, now over which building should be preserved and which knocked down or sold?
Millions. St. Bartholomew's is probably the main one, the church on Park Avenue, which is a church in a very crucial central location, designed by Bertram Goodhue, one of our great architects, and finished early in this century. It's Byzantine. The church wants to tear down its community house and put a 55-story glass building right next to it. So the church itself would stay, but the whole composition and the open space would all be destroyed. And that's really the main fight right now. I feel strongly against it, obviously.
Against tearing it down.
Against the plan. Yeah, I think it's... and it gets back to the reasons I've been talking about. I think a church has... There are a lot of ways a church serves the public. That particular building, by providing a beautiful piece of architecture and an oasis of open space in a place that's already too crowded and too tense, is performing a kind of religious function just by doing that. And by remaining the same, I think that too is if anything, enhancing the values of the church, which are to sort of tell us that there are some constants in this world. And the idea of saying that the church can serve its mission better by selling out to the needs of commerce and becoming just like any commercial enterprise and, you know, we want to hustle this piece of land for the most we can get out of it, I can't see how that enhances religious values more than the other, really. It seems to me, you know, that there's something's really gone askew here.
Well, in the architecture of a city, you have progress standing side by side with history.
Sure.
But when the two come into conflict, like in these battles about which should win out, progress or history, what kinds of questions do you think you should ask yourself?
Well, every situation is different. And as I said, a city that does not grow and change is going to die. But we've got to figure out, you know, where... somewhere we've got to draw the line. And... St. Bart's is a very difficult situation because it's really the last piece of land on Park Avenue, making it not only all the more valuable if the church wants to sell it, but it also makes it all the more valuable to have it not sold because it's sort of, in a sense, all we have left. And you have to really analyze each situation on its own. And every situation has its own meaning and ramification for what's around it and what its history is and all that stuff.
One of the really controversial things happening in many of the older cities now, including Philadelphia, is gentrification and redevelopment, the tearing down on the part of the city of buildings, frequently residential buildings that are old and decaying, and instead of rebuilding those, tearing them down and making way for new parts of Center City and new residential areas. And, of course, the controversy is about the people who have been displaced in the process. I don't know if similar things are happening in
New York. Always have, although gentrification I tend to think of more as meaning not tearing down buildings, but often the restoration of buildings in an old neighborhood, but the throwing out of a poorer class of people and bringing in of effectively, you know, sort of upwardly mobile young professionals and stuff.
Right, and in Philadelphia, both of them have happened in the past decade. Do you have, like, a stand on...
Well, that's a very tough thing. And I guess my stand depends on situation by situation. Nobody can be thrown out on the street. I mean, that's immoral and ridiculous and cannot be allowed. On the other hand, it's important to remember the history of every city has been one of ebb and flow of neighborhoods. If you're going to be really crass, you have to say that it is probably in the long-term interest of the city slightly better to have a broader economic base of upper-middle-class professionals within Center City. And yet, on the other hand, you know, you can't throw people out on the street. You simply can't. What we have to find is some sort of mechanism to guide and limit gentrification and to help rehouse some people who may be thrown away. I mean, we don't have good relocation programs. We don't do a lot of these things very well. It's very difficult because, you know, the one thing I don't want to sound like is like we're advocating a kind of urban planning version of social Darwinism, you know, that sort of, which obviously is despicable. On the other hand, the long-term health of the city is enhanced if it is able to have, as I said, a solid, large cadre of upper-middle-class people in its center.
Paul Goldberger, the New York Times architecture critic, is my guest if you're just joining us. How do you look at buildings? We're talking about architecture and of the city and of different cities. When you walk down the street and say it's a new city and you're curious about the architecture around you, from what vantage point will you look at it?
Well, it's hard to say. It's hard to generalize that way because it's sort of like saying, you know, how do you listen to music or how do you look at art? I mean, every day I hope my eyes get a little better. And you look in part with the memory of everything you've seen before as a reference point. I mean, Philadelphia is a great city to look at architecture in, not only because it has such a clear organization and plan and such great symbols like City Hall in the middle and PSFS nearby and all that other stuff. It also has so many great individual works of architecture. I mean, you know, I've mentioned already the Furness Pennsylvania Academy, the Kahn, Louis Kahn's Richards Laboratories at the university. It has the presence of Robert Venturi, who I think is one of the great American architects of our time, who's done not enough work in Philadelphia. I wish there were more, but some. And Romaldo Giurgola's work. I mean, there's a lot of interesting architecture in this city, both new and old. And so it's a wonderful place to sort of train an eye and just sort of keep looking and just stare at things and think about why they don't look like other things you've seen before.
Do you usually, like, circle around a building and go up to the sixth floor across the street and look at it? Because if you're talking about a skyscraper, you can't even see it if you're standing in front of
it. True. I try to see a building from as many vantage points as I can. I, of course, see it inside as well as out. I never write about a building I haven't seen. That's a rule I've had for a long time. And try to read something about it and talk to people involved in it as well.
How much has your feeling about buildings changed since when you were a kid? Or are there buildings that really left you cold when you were young that really have become very meaningful
much,
you now?
I can't think of specific buildings, but I can say I've gotten much more loose about liking a lot of historical buildings, old buildings. I used to think when I was a very snotty little kid that modern architecture was, you know, right and the only good thing, and most buildings were junky and fake and all that. Now I really like fake buildings. I mean, I like buildings that sort of do quirky things or have fake classical columns in them and that sort of stuff. And I've gotten much broader in what I like. I think I like good buildings of all styles when they're good.
I've come to have this slight appreciation for buildings with multicolored bricks.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, just like
sure.
two colors, for instance, mm-hmm. which seemed mm-hmm. really commonplace when I was growing up, but is like seldom done anymore.
I think we're going to see more of it now. I mean, I think there's much more of an interest in color in architecture today than there was 10 years ago. When you look at a building like Venturi Rauch's, that building out toward University of Pennsylvania, I forget what it's called.
The Science Center.
Science Center, exactly, yeah. With that wonderful, wild, colorful facade that looks like a computer printout or something that is really a very good solution to that kind of problem of making a simple, plain building interesting.
Let me quote you again and ask you if you could elaborate on this. Find the quote. This is a time much like the Baroque, a time of intricate and ironic visual tricks, exuberance, and self-indulgence.
Yeah, I think that's true. I'll buy that quote. We're at a time when we've moved away from the rigid orthodoxies of modern architecture, the rules that yielded a building like PSFS, for example, which were followed for so long, are now, I think, really out of favor and out of fashion. We tend to prefer eccentric buildings. We're much less moralistic about the use of historical forms, of ornament. We're much more willing to experiment and do unusual things. Those are all developments really of the last decade, essentially, I think.
Has that made it eclectic in the bad sense
of
the word?
I think it's eclectic in the good sense, although, of course, we're producing a lot of bad architecture as well as good architecture. We always have, and I think we probably always will. But it's certainly pluralist. I mean, there are a lot of different streams at this time, and that's interesting.
Is your architectural biases apparent in the place that you live?
Somewhat, not entirely. I mean, I live in a big New York apartment house that was built at the end of the 1920s and is... actually, sort of a little bit of Art Deco and a little bit of Italian Renaissance. So I guess it sort of is in the actual architecture of the building itself. Yeah, you know, putting aside what I've done inside. Yeah.
Well, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you.